Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, on Christmas Eve's Eve, we prepare a festive feast that you can copy at home. We discuss the power of ice.
The Library of Ice, so the title is really an ice core, which is nature's oldest form of preservation of stories.
And of course, ice has other uses too. No feast is complete without a drink. We get some recommendations.
Things, if you put ice in it, it's just going to melt and dilute the Bloody Mary. Yeah. So I think the key is to make your Bloody Mary as early as possible. I mean, the day before or a couple of hours before you plan to drink it, and just stuff it in the fridge or the freezer if you're really desperate.
All that to come this hour, live from London, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24. So, to begin today's show, as the big day quickly approaches, there may be some of you out there that need some last-minute tips to turn that Christmas chaos into a Christmas classic. So, we've handpicked the finest chefs from London's dining scene to join me in the studio to help you out. There is a slight kind of ulterior motive here, self-interest going on, I have to say. Simon Whiteside is the founder of Row, and brothers Alex and Oliver Santura are co-founders of Genesis in Shoreditch. So, welcome to all three of you to the programme.
Thank you for
having us. It's really great to have you here. And of course, you couldn't be more different, really, as chefs go. I wonder if I could start with you, Alex, because your family was involved with the meat business for generations. But in fact, you are a vegan chef. Give us the background to this.
Yeah, it's an ironic story, really. You kind of have to kind of imagine it, that the day we went to our dad, basically, he's been in the business for 45 years, and obviously his father before him and before him. We kind of turned around to him and said, "Dad, we're going to open a vegan restaurant." So he wasn't best pleased. No, he was fine with it. But yeah, just family's been in the meat business for over 100 years. They were actually farmers from Italy, came over during the Second World War, set up a meat van in Smithfield Market. The company went from strength to strength, grown, and actually now they're the largest importers and exporters of pork in the UK, second biggest meat factory in the UK. It's kind of a big conglomerate kind of meat company now.
Yeah.
He's the CEO. We actually used to work there ourselves many years ago. Ollie used to sweep pig fat off the floor.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
And now, of course, you're vegans. You're not even customers of your father's company now, are you? No. Ollie, tell us a little bit about your restaurant now.
Yeah, so our restaurant is an organic, plant-based restaurant. We try not to hold the vegan thing, more like plant-based, so it's more acceptable for everyone who wants to come. So it's not just, oh, you're a vegan, I'm not a vegan, I'm not going to come.
Yeah.
So I want to make it more sort of normal to just come to eat more plants during the week. So, yeah, we want to call it plant-based. It's a really cool vibe. It's basically all pink, the restaurant. Pink tiles, very, very cool interior, very Insta-worthy. And, yeah, we just serve really cool comfort food, hot dogs, burgers, street food from all around the world, basically.
Excellent. Well, Simon, let's move on to you, because you're from Ireland originally.
I am indeed, yeah.
Tell us about your culinary journey.
Well, my culinary journey started when I was 16, when I left school to become a chef. I worked in kind of quite high-end restaurants, one of them being Don Alfonso's, a three-star Michelin restaurant in Italy when I was 18, which was a huge eye-opener for me. Then I went on to kind of shadow Robin Gill, who has a dairy now, in his kind of early career as well. And then I kind of went from kind of fine dining. I ended up having a bit of an issue with my back, and I had to kind of take a little bit of a step back from that kind of quite high-end, high-intensity work. And I kind of fell into casual dining then, and I ended up opening some kind of casual concepts, a fish and chip concept called Hook and Biamara over in Belgium. And now I've got to the stage in my career where after 6 years of doing casual dining, I'm kind of itching to get back into slightly higher end dining now. And I've just opened Row just about 6 weeks ago now. And yeah, so we're kind of taking a high-end but casual look at British seafood and only using kind of very sustainable seasonal fish from Cornwall and trying to make it more accessible. I think seafood restaurants tend to have a bit of a stigma of being a little bit expensive, a little bit stuffy. So we're trying to break that barrier and make it really, really accessible and fun for everyone and at a good price point as well.
Fantastic. Well, listen, you've all brought in examples, which is so wonderful. Very happy about that. So Christmas Day, in a sort of traditional British fashion, would start off quite often with a fish starter. Then you'd go on to the main course, which would often be turkey or a ham, something like that. Always with Brussels sprouts. Nobody likes them, but everybody always says Brussels sprouts. And then of course, you would have pudding. So what we've got here is, Simon, with your starter. So tell us about this.
Well, for our starter this year, I kind of decided to do a ceviche, so not very traditional. But I think it's really nice, you know, as Christmas dinner is so big and heavy, I think it's nice to start with something quite light. So I've got some beautiful Cornish black bream here. And we're doing a little bit of a twist on it. It's actually a poutine ceviche. So poutine being Irish moonshine, essentially. And this wasn't made in a bathtub somewhere. This is actually made by my friend Dave Mulligan. It's called Bone Poutine, and it's excellent liquor, and it complements this so well with lime.
I feel like
coriander.
We can't carry on talking about it without us actually having a sip.
This is a good interactional idea.
So thank you. Oh, look, and this gorgeous little shot glass
Flauncha.
As well. And so what, do you have to, you don't have to chuck it back though, do you?
You don't have to.
That's good. That's very good. So, now, we're not being rude by not offering Oliver and... Alex, any of this, you have decided that that's not what you feel like at this time in the morning. So, but anyway, this is very much used in your ceviche.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think, you know, it's such a clean, liquor. It complements the lime and the cucumber and the onion in it so well. And it's just a really nice light way to start the festivities.
And I guess also because cooking the main meal is such a path, and there's all of this stuff about timing and trying to get everything ready at the same time, that if you have a starter that you can make ahead, as you do with
Absolutely,
ceviche, then you've got a whole extra layer of worry that's just taken off you.
Yeah,
you?
For me, I've started prepping already, you know. I was cooking my ham yesterday.
Wow.
And yeah, I think anything that you can do before is fantastic, so you can just enjoy the day.
Yeah. Can we try it?
Yes, absolutely.
There we go. Oh, that looks so divine. Okay, so what kind of fish is this again?
So this is a Cornish black bream. And we just got some thinly sliced cucumber.
Oh,
we just deseeded it and sliced it with a little bit of red onion. And then with in the lime juice, you grate ginger and a little bit of garlic and chop up a bit of chilli, and you toss that through it, and then just finish it with a little bit of the poutine.
It's so good.
So really, really light, really, really fresh, you know, really kind of...
Absolutely zinging, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Where can you get this at Roe? Where is Roe?
Roe is in Pop Brixton, down in Brixton. And it's in a shipping container, which is kind of a bit of fun as well, you know. And yeah, it's quite small. We've only got 16 seats inside. We're communal dining. We've taken a really casual approach to it, and the menu is just ever changing and kind of trying to keep it fun and interesting like this. We always serve a little chaser of bon poutine with the ceviche as well.
Fantastic. Well, you did tell me I didn't have to do it as a shot. I seem to have finished it in two gulps. Let's go on to the main course now. Now, we're going to leave aside things like turkey and ham and all the rest of it and talk about sprouts, because what is it about sprouts?
I don't know. I like sprouts.
do you like sprouts, Alex?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Ollie?
Yeah, I love them.
Okay. You are the only people in the world who do, I think. But there are ways to make them interesting, and that's exactly what you've done.
There's plenty of ways to make it interesting, you know. And one of the things I like to do, there's an interesting people do with fish sauce and Brussels sprouts, which, you know, it's not to everyone's taste, so I wouldn't put that on the Christmas table. But I've kind of adapted that, and I've made an anchovy emulsion, and I've roasted off the Brussels sprouts and tossed it in an anchovy emulsion, which I think is really nice. I think the saltiness really kind of really helps the Brussels sprouts.
Do you have that with you?
I certainly do, yeah.
So, okay, maybe this is my moment with
sprouts. I think it is, you know. I think you should go for it.
Oh, they look lovely. I love the way they're sort of roasty coloured. They're nicely dark.
So what I like to do is I just trim the bottom and the outer leaves off, and then I cut them down the centre of the root, and then in a nice hot pan with a bit of oil, you put them face down So then you get this beautiful caramelization on the actual Brussels sprouts themselves, and then you just finish them in the oven with a little bit of butter. How's that going?
Really
there?
Delicious. Nice, I'll take it all back. Sprouts are fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow. Do you write these recipes down anywhere? I mean, can I cook that at home?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's so easy, you know.
Do you have a book yet?
Not yet.
So we know what's
coming.
Watch
this space.
Absolutely. Well, after that, of course, you go on to pudding. Now, Christmas dinner, a traditional Christmas dinner for people who want to eat purely plant-based foods, once upon a time wouldn't have been easy. But in fact, it's perfectly possible to have a wonderful, nearly traditional meal without having any meat at all, isn't it, Alex?
100%. We kind of make it kind of a custom. We kind of, you kind of do exactly the same kind of Christmas lunch as you're kind of used to. You just kind of no turkey or a different kind of style of gravy. We normally kind of get a butternut squash, cut it in half, make like a vegan kind of stuffing that tastes, I mean, our family obviously eats a lot of meat, they can't tell the difference. We stuff the squash with the stuffing and then roast that. That's kind of like the main kind of, you know, the star of the kind of the dish, and then the rest of it is kind of exactly the same. Pudding wise again, you don't really kind of miss it anything else as well. And do you want to try some of this?
I would. So yeah. Tell me what this... First of all, it looks absolutely beautiful. What is it?
So basically, it's a raw chocolate cheesecake with amaretto and rum.
Wow.
So it hasn't been cooked at all.
Yeah, it's completely raw.
Oh, look at this, with a great big cherry on it, and there's all sorts of fruit and almonds. Oh, and just... is that mistletoe?
On top it's mistletoe on top with blackberries, raspberries, blue cherries. You've got pecans, walnuts, almonds.
That's really good.
It's also made... The whole thing's organic as well.
Mm-hmm.
We're very big into organic food. Obviously, Genesis is organic as well. I think we're one of the only organic restaurants in London as well. That's good.
How difficult is it to source... Sorry, I'm speaking with my mouth.
Yeah, sure.
How difficult is it to source, Oliver, all your right. sort of top quality organic ingredients?
Yeah, it's very challenging. There's not many companies do organic in London. There's only two sort of... You've got Choice Organics, Landridge Organics, that's it, basically. To source all specialised... We do a thing called Char Kway Teow on the menu. And it's very, very... It's a black bean paste that you need in the Char Kway Teow. It's a street food in Malaysia.
Mm.
You get it on the markets, basically. And basically, it's got the black beans, fermented black beans, and you only can get them from, basically, Malaysia. So we had to... Obviously, it has to be organic because it's soy. And basically, the thing with soy about the GMO, genetically modified organisms in soy, basically. So we had to find a supplier in Malaysia to get these amazing black bean, basically fermented black beans that we use in our Char Kway Teow. And obviously, that's had to get that link to find the organic certification to get it to England.
Right.
So we do... There's certain things that we need that you can't get in England, basically, that we have to get from abroad. So it's very challenging to get, you know, to stick to that organic. But actually, we do it. Right. We go through that sort of boundaries to get.
I want to offer Simon some of this because I think you absolutely have to taste.
I was actually waiting for
this
cake. It looks amazing.
How much collaboration goes on between chefs in different restaurants? I mean, obviously you are competitors, but you're serving completely different things. How much do you all talk to each other outside of a kind of radio studio?
Sorry, my mouth is full.
For us,
it's delicious.
We're so busy kind of just kind of day in, day out in the restaurant. There's not a time for really for
collaboration.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe it's different for you, I'm not sure. But for us, we're just kind of heads down, just kind of, you know, we've been open for a few months. So we've kind of just kind of coming out of that kind of dizzy spell. And now we're kind of looking back into kind of working some new and just going back into the test kitchen, kind of creating some new recipes, that kind of stuff again. We take some inspiration from around the world, from different chefs and stuff, but in terms of collaboration, we're not doing that at the moment.
Yeah. How about you, Simon? Do you find that...
Well, I'm still very much in that dizzy space at the moment. Absolutely. Like, I love to try and take inspiration from eating out places and anywhere I can get it, really, you know? At the moment, though, it's very much just... I've been in the restaurant every service now since we've been open. And it's just been a bit hectic, so I haven't had the time to kind of do any of that. Kind of,
it's,
you know,
a hard life, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, a very hard life. So what are you going to be doing on your own Christmas days, Alex?
So, yeah, just family. I've got a young family, got a one-year-old son. Oh, so wow. Just kind of doing a home kind of family, wife's parents coming over. Yeah, doing a vegan roast, basically, is what we're kind of doing.
Yeah. Whenever anybody says vegan roast, you always think it's kind of a nut roast that's not very imaginative, and it's just kind of, I know all my good vegan friends are like, please don't just give me a nut roast and some lentils.
No. We're actually doing the squash stuffing thing.
Yeah.
So we kind of did that kind of the last few Christmases. It's worked very well. Everyone loves it. So it's a classic in our household.
Yeah. And Simon?
Well, I have my in-laws over as well. I have a young family as well. I've got a four-month-old Charlie and a just-turned five-year-old Lily, who'll be listening now as well. So, hello, Lily. I got quite traditional with Christmas, actually. I've got turkey and ham. I have my sprouts. I'll probably do them with bacon, if I'm honest with you, tomorrow. I'll kind of have all the trimmings. The one thing I don't have is a Christmas cake. I'm not a huge fan of Christmas cake, so I'll be doing a spiced stout cake with Bailey's cream, is it?
Well, can I recommend this cake, which is all organic and absolutely fantastic. Really, really lovely. Listen, thank you all so much for coming. That's Simon Whiteside of Roe and Alex and Oliver Santoro from Genesis. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Up next, as winter sets in, we look at the power of ice.
Premiering at 10 a.m. London time on Saturdays, our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé, or Tom Edwards when Tyler is on the road, presents a weekly 30-minute program that celebrates print media.
Our paper is incredibly expensive. The paper is too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time.
Listening to Sunday Brunch. Now, we've probably all seen some of it in the Northern Hemisphere this week as winter truly arrives. It's ice. Nancy Campbell is a poet, editor, writer and publisher, and she's the author of The Library of Ice, where she examines the impact of ice on our lives at a time when ice itself is under threat from climate change. She joined me earlier and began by talking about the premise of the book.
I was working in a wonderful antiquarian book dealers in Covent Garden, and I was lucky enough to have the archives of famous writers passing through my hands on the way to being preserved in institutions like the British Library and other places. But I did have a sense of all this paper and all these wonderful words being really quite temporal because of the changing climate and being aware that so much of our cities are under threat from rising sea levels. So I got interested in how nature might preserve stories. I ended up going to the most northern museum in the world, in Greenland, to find out more about how stories are preserved in other ways than through texts, in oral cultures, and also in nature itself. The Library of Ice, of the title, is really an ice core, which is nature's oldest form of preservation of stories.
And in terms of the museum itself, you talk in your introduction about how the museum encourages you to leave your visual art behind, but wants you to take away your words.
Yes, it was a really interesting job in that respect. I've worked in a lot of institutions where you're actually encouraged to create a work very quickly and put it forward to the public. But in Greenland, I found people didn't really mind that there was an actual result. They really wanted me to go away, back to the UK, back to Europe, and talk about my experiences and sort of share their stories. The islanders were really generous in telling me about their way of life, sharing dinners with me, sharing friendships, and they wanted to kind of communicate that lifestyle to a wider audience, and they chose me as the person to do it, which was a very great honour indeed.
You talk about how it's hard to see the boundaries of an object when you don't have the words for what it is you're seeing. How did the work come together? How did those words form themselves for you?
It's a really strange thing, going to a completely new culture and writing about it, working in response to it. And I spoke to many other artists, actually, who'd worked in the Arctic, and we all shared this feeling that it's initially quite hard to respond to, for example, ice, when you're not used to seeing it every day. How do you create the lens through which to understand what you're seeing? And I did that partly through conversations with the islanders who knew probably more than anyone in the world about ice, and also through reading books, which is my usual default when I don't understand something. So reading enormous meteorological organization texts, which describe every last minutiae of nuance of ice. Also looking at dictionaries in different languages, so to see more about the ways indigenous people across North America and Greenland might categorize ice formations.
Insofar as all art is political, I wonder how political this book is for you.
I don't think it's a hugely political book. I obviously, in writing about ice today, you have to consider climate change and the disappearance of the ice and the way that's going to affect everyone's lives, not just the lives of people living in the Arctic. I'm particularly struck at the end. I write about the small island nations who've been in the news quite a bit recently. The population of small island nations are becoming climate refugees. That's obviously the background to my story, but I don't want it to be a book for this year. I think the situation is constantly changing, and I write a lot about ice in art, ice in sport, so I really want to celebrate ice throughout culture rather than making a polemic about climate change.
Really, it was a gift for the people that you spent the time with, a gift for the museum as well as for your readers.
Well, I made two books, actually. I wrote this book, The Library of Ice, which I hope is for a wider audience. And I made another book, How to Say I Love You in Greenlandic, an Arctic Alphabet, which is an artist book, illustrated a dictionary of 12 different words in Greenlandic and English. And that was very much designed for the Greenlandic and Danish-speaking audience on the island.
And insofar as any of them have read The Library of Ice yet, what has the response been?
I have a response from the museum director in Ilulissat, who liked it very much. But the population on Upernavik are Greenlandic and Danish speakers mainly, so that's why I made the other book for them, How to Say I Love You in Greenlandic.
Nancy Campbell. The Library of Ice is out now. It's published by Scribner. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. Now it's time for a regular Sunday Brunch feature called Weekend Reads. So each week I speak to a different author about their latest work. And James Geary is the deputy curator of the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard. He's the editor of Nieman Reports and a former editor of the European edition of Time magazine. His latest book is Wit's End: What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It. It explores every facet of wittiness. He writes each chapter in a style that exemplifies a different kind of wit. As he explained,
wit is the ability to make surprising connections between seemingly unrelated things. You know, people think of wit and they think, well, that's all about being funny and making jokes. And it is, but there are many other kinds of wit as well. There's like the scientific wit of discovery, being able to see how something in one field is connected to another field, and you bring those two things together and you have an invention or a scientific discovery. And that's the surprise of making that unexpected connection. That's wit. And that happens in jokes, but it also happens in innovation and discovery. It happens in visual arts, which can also be witty. And it happens, for example, it can be also physical wit, like a clown or a silent comedian. And so I think I've finally gotten to how the fundamental kind of principle on which human creativity works. And I think it's wit.
And it's beautifully written. In every single chapter, you change your style according to what type of wit you're talking about. The style changes utterly. Give us some examples of that.
Well, it's interesting. That was not my original idea for how to write the book. So, for example, there's these different kinds of wit, and not all of them are funny. So there's one chapter, for example, that's about how wit might work in the brain. And there are certain neurological conditions where people have damage to certain parts of their brain and they suddenly start making puns all the time or cracking jokes all the time. So I wanted to explore that. And so I wrote that chapter in the style of a scientific paper. There's also a chapter about verbal wit, you know, repartee and banter and things like that. So I wrote that in the style of a dramatic dialogue, like a scene from a play. There's also spiritual wit when you're kind of dealing with existential questions in your life. And so I wrote that in the style of a sermon. There's one chapter that's written as a rap because I think rap lyrics are incredibly witty and incredibly clever, and they demonstrate a really high degree of linguistic and also kind of philosophical wit. But I only came to that conclusion because my son is an actor and he went to drama school, and he told me one day that they were discussing wit in class. And I said, oh, okay, well, tell your teacher I'm writing a book about that and I'll come and give a talk if she would like. And at the time I was trying to write a conventional book about wit, and it was terrible. It was really horrible because I was doing that thing that you should never do when you're talking about jokes. I was explaining the joke, and it was really boring. Even to me, it was really boring. So I knew it wasn't going to work for readers. But then I was there in front of my son's drama class, and we were doing this interaction and workshop around wit, and I realized, why am I trying to write about wit? I should make the book witty by writing in a style that exemplifies the kind of wit that I'm writing about. So that's how I ended up writing each chapter in a totally different style.
And you set yourself another challenge because you gave yourself very precise word counts.
Ah, yes. And that has to do with my work as a journalist. Every chapter is built around a very specific word count, and it's based on multiples of four. So many of the sections in the book are exactly 800 words long. And that's because when I worked for Time, a one-page feature story in Time magazine was about 800 words. And 800 words is kind of a standard measurement in journalism for what a kind of an article that can be read and consumed relatively quickly, but still have enough time and space to impart some important information. That's about 800 words. So I kind of set myself that challenge because another part of wit is working within very tight constrictions or having very, very limited resources. And I wanted to pose myself that challenge to be able to explain something really, which is kind of complicated and has lots of implications for other fields and other areas of endeavor and things like that, but to do it in a way that was very compressed and to impose not just the stylistic restriction on myself, but also the length restriction, so that I had to do something very quickly, but that had a lot of depth and a lot of complexity, because that's how wit works in real life, too. Wit is usually very brief, a witty remark, a sudden insight, an exclamation. Wit happens very, very quickly, and it's kind of has this improvisational aspect to it. So I wanted to try and realize that as well in the book.
Finally, James, the book is called Wit's End: What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It. Why do we need it?
Well, because I think what wit is the kind of intellectual ability to make connections between seemingly unrelated things. And I think today, if you look at the challenges that are facing us, whether they're political, whether they're environmental, social, reading the newspaper every day, it can be very, very discouraging to see on almost every front so many areas of tension and so much discord. And I think why we need wit today more than ever is because wit is that ability of the human mind to reconcile contrasting forces, to take things that are seemingly opposite or seemingly unrelated and to create a kind of synthesis and to bring those things together in some kind of resolution or innovation. And if you look at any single issue in the world today, like the environment, it's related to politics, it's related to economics, it's related to social issues. Every issue that we're facing today that we need to solve as a society is complex, and it's made up of issues that are from totally different fields. So I think the reason why wit is needed, and the title of the book is also a pun, Wit's End, can be at the end of your wits, meaning you can't find a solution, but wit's end is also wit's purpose. What is the purpose of wit? Mm. I think the purpose of wit is to enable us to synthesize all these different things and come to a positive resolution. And to do that, we really, really, as a society and individually, need to keep our wits about us.
That was James Geary. Wits End, What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It is out now. Now, to hear more from authors, check out Meet the Writers. You can find the full back catalogue online at monocle.com. Up next, Johnny Ray on drinking. Cheers.
California, here we come. Monocle has arrived on the West Coast. Our new shop and bureau is open at Platform, the design quarter in Culver City that's home to 100 boutique retail and culinary brands. If you're in town, pop along to meet the team, pick up the latest issue of the magazine and browse our exclusive collaborations. From elegant stationery to smart jackets, plus plenty in the way of print, of course. Discover our range from furniture to fragrances, courtesy of brands from the US and beyond. Intrigued? Then come and see us at our new LA outpost at Platform in Culver City. We look forward to meeting you there.
Time now to get into the Christmas spirit, or spirits, and who better to facilitate than Jonathan Ray. Jonathan started out as a drinks editor of GQ and spent many years as a wine editor at the Daily Telegraph. He's now drinks editor of The Spectator and a wine columnist at The Field. He's also the author of several books on wine, including his previous award-winning Drink More Fizz. Now, we discussed that previously here on Monocle 24 and had great fun with it. And as I recall, we weren't entirely sober. Thanks so much for coming back after that really badly behaved episode.
Well,
as far
a pleasure.
As I recall.
It's a pleasure. Yes, it was very fizzy, wasn't it? It was lovely.
Now, you do lots of things. You have your regular drinks columns. You write on food, travel, lifestyle. And, of course, you also assist in making the award-winning Brighton Gin.
Absolutely.
Well, I guess that making gin is possibly part of the inspiration for your new book, which is all about spirits. That's the Spirit, in fact, is the title of the book. That's about 100 spirits and liqueurs.
Yes, it's my favourite 100 spirits, liqueurs and digestifs to drink with style. And I must say, it's been fascinating to research. There's some obvious ones in there, like, I don't know, Grand Marnier, Courvoisier, Cognac, Green Chartreuse, Benedictine and so on. But I like to think there's some sort of slightly wackier, more obscure ones as well. Mm-hmm. It's been hard work researching them. My liver is shot to pieces, but it has been fascinating.
And you did it all for us.
Absolutely. I'm very, very selfless.
Well, listen, I'm happy to sacrifice a tiny bit of my health in the interest of research too, because I feel it's important that the listeners know exactly what it is that we're talking about, and that can't happen unless
I like your attitude, Georgina. That's perfect. Perfect.
This book is not just about the spirits. It's insider tales about the producers and what makes certain brand so enduring, why some drinks just taste the best and how best to drink them.
Yes, I like to think so. I mean, so many of these spirits have fascinating stories, and that really actually is not so much how they're made, but it's who makes them and why and where that really fascinates me. I mean, I don't want to be too highbrow and go on about social history, but that is what motivates me as much as the nice kick it gives you when you drink a spirit.
Mm. Is there a story that you could tell that would seamlessly segue into us tasting something?
Well, the first thing I brought with me, Georgina, you were so insistent that I brought some things to start your day off well. I brought a Bloody Mary, and this is basically a health drink. And there's no question, the Bloody Mary can stand in for pretty much any meal of the day. Just think of the vitamin B6, the vitamin C, the niacin, the dietary fibre in the tomato juice. So I brought my homemade Bloody Mary, which I'm just going to pour into this glass here.
So there's an age-old argument about whether or not you should have ice with a Bloody Mary.
Ideally not, though we do have ice here because it's not madly cold.
Thank you.
The thing is, if you put ice in it, it's just going to melt and dilute the Bloody Mary. So yeah. I think the key is to make your Bloody Mary as early as possible. I mean, the day before or a couple of hours before you plan to drink it, and just stuff it in the fridge or the freezer if you're really desperate.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'm going to have a sip while you tell us what's in this and what makes it special.
Okay. Well, I do think the Bloody Mary is the perfect cocktail. Mm. As I said just now, it stands in for pretty much any meal of the day. It's vodka, of course. And I think the key is to have good vodka, but excellent tomato juice. The tomato juice I use, and I stress, and I say this in the book, I haven't been paid or cajoled or bullied or bribed to say this. The best tomato juice is made at the tomato stall in the Isle of Wight. It's unbelievable. They do a red one and a golden tomato juice. No citric acid added, no salt added. It is just 100% squished tomato. And oh my goodness, it's good. So this has tomato juice, vodka, Worcester sauce, Tabasco, celery salt, sherry, which I think is the key to a fine Bloody Mary, fresh lemon juice and a little bit of fresh orange juice as well. So I think the orange juice and the sherry just lift it from the mundane into something really quite tasty.
Well, and this really is incredibly tasty. It
should be savoury with a little bit of sweetness, so you can just tell there's a little bit of orange in there. I think it's a delicious drink. It's variously credited to Fernand Petiot, who is a barman, and I think at the St. Regis Hotel, or the actor George Jessel, who first mixed tomato and vodka together. And everyone has their own recipe. That's what's so lovely. You know, it's like, I don't know, a beef stew or something. Everyone has their own way of doing it, and everyone's very protective of their own recipe.
This is very, very delicious, but I feel that we should be moving on.
Gosh, you're impatient, Georgina, but of course. Well, the next one I've brought with me is, if the Bloody Mary has to be made in a particular way and everyone has their own way of doing it, and Kingsley Amis, for example, put in ketchup in his Bloody Mary, I like to put a stick of celery, and sometimes if I'm in need of solids, bit of streaky bacon as well, just to stir it around and munch on.
Good heavens.
But a Bloody Mary has to be
cooked.
Done the way... Yeah, cooked. Good. But a nice, you know, a really crispy bit of bacon. It's perfect. It's breakfast. Yeah. If that's the complicated one that has to be done properly, this is the simplest of all cocktails and one of the most popular at the moment, the Negroni. Created, depends which book you believe or which source you believe, by Count Camillo Negroni. Some people say it was him, some say it was another branch of the Negroni family, but it was certainly one of the Negronis. And Count Camillo Negroni wanted to beef up his Americano, and he added gin instead of soda water. It's so simple. It's one third gin, one third Campari, and one third sweet red vermouth. It's quite pokey. It's not a light cocktail.
As you say, relevant for the moment, because actually it is enjoying a moment right now. It's become fashionable. How does that happen, these kind of fashions in drinks? Thank you.
I don't know. Well, there is such a revolution at the moment for cocktails. Ooh. I mean, cocktails are so popular at the moment. I don't know. There's just a fashion for cocktails, and some just, I hate the word zeitgeist, where they just hit the right feeling. And Negroni is so popular at the moment, partly because it's, in a way, so simple, but so beautiful. You can use all sorts of different gins, different vermouths. You can have a rum Negroni, you can have a tequila Negroni that's known as a Tugroni. You can substitute absinthe, and there are all sorts of things you can do to a Negroni. But the perfect Negroni is just one third each of those ingredients. And you want a really good gin, a really good vermouth. I used Fox Denton 48 gin in this and Antica Formula vermouth, which I think is delicious. I once interviewed Bompas and Parr. I don't know if you know Bompas and Parr, the jelly mongers, these two crazy boys who make the most amazing jellies, erotic jellies, architectural jellies, all sorts of jellies. I think The Guardian called them culinary deviants. And they've written a couple of beautiful books about jelly. Anyway, they told me, and of course every parent knows this, I'm a very idle parent, that anyone who makes jelly, that all you need is imagination, liquid and gelatin. So I interviewed them and I went straight home and made a Negroni jelly.
Divine. Right, what else do we have?
You're rushing me through my Negroni, Georgina, my goodness.
I'm sorry. I'm so anxious to have a little sip of everything that we've got in front of
us. This you will love. This is grappa. Now, grappa, you have to, well, normally I'd say drink with caution. This comes from Nardini, who are the oldest grappa producers of all, founded in 1779 in Bassano in Vicenza in northeast Italy. And there's a beautiful covered wooden bridge in Bassano, the Ponte Vecchio, not the Ponte Vecchio in Florence, but another Ponte Vecchio. I think it's called the Ponte degli Alpini as well. And it was built by Palladio in 1569. It was beaten up by the Austrians and the French during the Napoleonic Wars, and also by the retreating Germans during the Second World War. But it's been restored. It's still there. And at one end of the bridge is the Grapperia Nardini. And the Nardini brothers have been making fine grappa since, as I say, 1779. This grapperia has been there ever since. And it's a small wooden panelled shop. And it opens at 8 in the morning, Georgina, which is its busiest time. And it's 8 in the morning for the good folk of Bassano on their way to work. They drop off at the grapperia and they either have a caffè corretto, which is a corrected coffee, which is an espresso coffee corrected by the addition of a shot of grappa, which they swirl around and slurp, or they have a cafe rassentin, which I think is even better, which is where you have an espresso coffee with those, you know, those big brown granules of sugar, and you have the coffee, but you drink the coffee before the sugar melts, then you add some grappa and you swirl it around. So, and it's the warmth of the cup, the crunchiness of the sugar, the headiness of the spirit, just create an almost perfect taste sensation. And this grappa, a lot of grappas have these quite undigestible oils in them that make you feel pretty sick after drinking them. Nardini take out these oils, and this is infused with almonds. So mandorla, it's a mandorla grappa, almond grappa. And I think, oh my God, it's good.
And I mean, this is the genius of this book, is that you're not just saying, well, here's a great grappa. It's about time and place and who the producers are and the stories behind it. Lots of fantastic stories behind it. One of the things that I was interested in was the connection between a French liqueur and the Burnley Miners Social Club.
Yeah. Well, that's a lovely story. And I was really quite touched by it. And I didn't know it at all. But yes, there's a liqueur called Benedictine that's made in Fécamp in northern France. And the history is a little blurred. The guy who he came up with the recipe, and he says he found this recipe in the Benedictine Abbey at Fécamp, a medieval recipe. Some people say he just created the recipe himself in the 1870s, I think it was. Either way, he came up with this really lovely liqueur, and he built the Palais de Benedictine in which to make it, and was knighted by the Pope for his trouble. And yes, curious enough, the biggest consumer of Benedictine in the world is the Burnley Miners Working Men's Social Club. And it's a lovely tale. During the First World War, the East Lancashire Regiment was based in Fécamp, including the Accrington Pals Battalion, and very famously. And the poor guys, I mean, they were miserable, they were cold, they were terrified. And what better way to keep the cold out and keep their spirits up than have Benedictine? And they would have it as a Benny and hot, which was half and half with hot water. So Benedictine with hot water. And the few that returned to Burnley and Bury and all around there in East Lancashire, they took this love of Benedictine back with them. And I was relating this at a tasting event to do with the book recently. And there was a guy from Burnley there. And I said, anyone know who drinks more Benedictine than anyone else? He said, I do, lad. Burnley. And he was really quite tearful about it. He says, I've never had this outside Burnley. I didn't know you drank it as a shot after a meal or with ice or something. He said, I only ever have it as a Benny and hot, which is still 100 years later, they drink a Benny and hot, and they get through about 1,000 bottles a year. And I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying that Burnley Football Club is part sponsored by Benedictine, or at least they get through 12 bottles every home game.
I think we have one last thing to taste.
We do.
And what is that?
So this is... really, I mean, it's a brown spirit like whiskey and like cognac, but it's a rum. Oh. And rum, if we're going through a gin revolution, we're certainly going through a rum revolution too. And rum, of course, is made either from molasses or from fermented sugarcane juice. This comes from Venezuela, and it's Santa Teresa, 1796. A lot of it just gets drowned in Coke or used in cocktails, but this is a sipping rum that you'd have on its own. And it comes from, as I say, Santa Teresa, which was founded in 1796, still owned by the same family in the Revenja province, southwest of Caracas. And talking about lovely stories, I mean, I've been to this distillery. I love its rum. It's sort of toffee, and there's sort of candied orange and dried orange peel. It's owned by the Vollmer family, fourth generation. And the extraordinary thing is there's a rugby pitch there. And to my knowledge, they don't play rugby in Venezuela. You know, they play in Argentina very famously and a little bit in Chile. But Alberto Vollmer, when he was a student in Paris in the 70s, 80s, I think it was, he fell in love with rugby. There are a lot of gangs in this part of Venezuela. And until, I think it was 2003, there were about 120 murders per 100,000 population. And he, Alberto, saw the way to reduce his violence and to disband the gangs was to introduce rugby. So all these gang members have put down their weapons, and they now play rugby, beat hell out of each other on the rugby pitch, but they don't kill each other. And the murder rate has plummeted, and all the workers at the distillery play rugby. A lot of the gangs have now disbanded and formed rugby teams. But anyway, this is the most, I think, a delicious rum. It's really toffee. It's so accessible. Made by the Solera system, where they have barrels on top of each other and the rum's drawn off the bottom barrels, new rum's added to the barrels at the top, and it trickles down. So it always tastes the same. It's how they make sherry and Madeira and Marsala and so on. But I mean, I think that's pretty Christmassy. Mm.
Well, let me toast both you, Jonathan Ray, this wonderful rum, Christmas, nice. And of course, your wonderful book. It's called That's the Spirit, 100 of the World's Greatest Spirits, Liqueurs and Digestifs to Drink with Style. It's out now. It's published by Quadrille. Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Well, I do feel that I should point out that I actually did do that interview yesterday and I hadn't been solidly drinking for at least the last hour. So that was Johnny Ray and his book is That's the Spirit. It's time now to have a look at the weekend papers and I'm joined in the studio by Marie Bion, who is a journalist for French media. Welcome, Marie. Thanks so much for coming in on this very busy day for many people.
Yes, yes.
Shall we start with this extraordinary story? I mean, we've been following what's been happening with these drones at Gatwick. Now, we know that there have been a couple of arrests and the drones are now down. But there are now, having had a complete failure to deal with it, it would seem, up until this point, efforts to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Yes, yes. And the front page of the Sunday Times, they're talking about bazookas being used to snare airport drones. So it looks not very safe for people who are going to fly today. But be reassured, these are not real bazookas with fire, basically. The person who would use the bazooka, if they are indeed used, but apparently that's going to happen in the next few weeks, would fire a net that would catch the drone. And then there would be some kind of parachute that would deploy and the drone would be basically going on the ground lightly. So that would be the main weapon, a non-lethal weapon against the drones. Of course, I mean we can guess in the report that if they use that when the airport is working, they will have to ground flight for some time because you don't want to have a net hitting an airplane either. So it doesn't seem like a long-term solution in a way. So they're talking as well about other solutions like, you know, some kind of magnetic nets around the airport and all that. So the ministers are going to announce some kind of bigger consultation very soon and more things being done at the start of the year. But of course, that arrives a bit too late, of course, for all those people, those more than 100,000 people who were left stranded in Gatwick, being completely at a loss. I was there, of course, there. And I saw a young girl, she was 19, first time she was in the airport alone, she was an au pair and she was due to come back to Finland, but she couldn't go to Finland before the 25th because of that. And she had nowhere to stay because her au pair family had been able to get to their flight because they went on another airport. So all this is going to be very not reassuring when you think you're going to go to the airport when they use bazooka, and it's not going to change anything for all those people who have their Christmas possibly ruined because of that.
And that article, I think, goes on to talk about the risk of drones generally, how, in fact, we're seeing a resurgence of Al-Qaeda, how they're looking at drones now, that might be a delivery vehicle for chemical weapons and so on.
That was the main fear at the start. When we saw those drones, the authorities thought maybe it was some kind of newfangled terrorist attack, and therefore they could be using the drones not just to disrupt the traffic but also to land something or to send something. Very quickly they thought that it wasn't the case, that it was more someone playing up with them in a way. But yes, that's a fear that's going to be taken more seriously because of what happened, although it wasn't exactly the real threat at the time. But that's something that's been basically on the books for the researchers for quite a long time, because we know this technology basically is available to almost anyone. So someone with a nefarious intent can absolutely use drones to do immense damage. So that's what one of the things that the ministers are going to talk about at the start of the year, hopefully, to try and not only basically restrict the possibility to fly a drone, but also perhaps the tariff that someone can have if they do use these drones for nefarious intents.
Yeah. Let's move on now to The Observer. And the police are investigating a yellow vest group that has intimidated a Tory MP.
Yes, it was on Thursday, I believe. It was Anna Soubry, so the Conservative pro-European in favour of a second referendum MP, Conservative MP. That's important to say that, because that's why she was heckled by this guy. He basically followed her for a full 5 minutes when she was going from the Parliament to the Green when she was giving an interview to a TV station. And this guy followed her with shoving her his cell phone on her face because he wanted to see her face while he was basically insulting her. He called her a traitor. He called her a shame for the nation. He said that she was on the side of Hitler because she wanted to have a second referendum. And all the while, sometimes sometimes he just turns the phone to himself, and we can see that he's got a yellow vest on him. And other photographers who saw basically what was happening so clearly showed that he had a yellow vest on him. So at the start, I mean, we didn't think a lot about the fact that he had a yellow vest. But then the observer, as doing a bit of work, and uncovered a willingness from far-right groups to try and recuperate the yellow vest movements in France. So we know for 5 weeks now, yellow vests protesters in France have been blocking the country, especially on the weekends, because they want to be heard and they want to... At first, they wanted basically to have a tax on fuel being taken out. Basically, they managed that, but now they have a bigger agenda. And apparently, some in the UK want to recuperate this fight of the yellow vest, and they're calling themselves. There's a Facebook group, apparently, according to the Observer, who's calling himself the official branch of the yellow vest in the UK. Another one, the Liberty Defenders, has been all created, or at least had been linked to Nick Griffin, who was the founder of one of the major extreme right group in the UK. So apparently, basically, those people saw kind of kindred spirit in the yellow vest, because they're fighting for civil rights. And in the UK, it takes the form of fighting for Brexit, because they kind of think that for some people, the vote for Brexit was against the globalization and the elite in favor of globalization. So they saw Brexit as the solution to all this. But apparently, so far, and the Observer doesn't really mention anything on the kind, but there's no link between the French yellow vest and the UK yellow vest. The yellow vest in France are not even organized in themselves in France, so there's little hope that there's any organization between the UK and the French ones.
Marie, it's been a very traumatic year, hasn't it? Do you think you need a drink?
Yes, maybe. Why not? Yeah, what time is it? Not look at the clock. No,
Look at the clock. No. Because fantastically, we've actually asked Simon to stay on. That's Simon Whiteside, who's the founder of Row, this wonderful fish restaurant. He's still here and he has his Irish moonshine.
I do.
I think you should give Maria a wee dram. Oh, no, that's Scottish, isn't it? What do you say when you're giving somebody a... Oh, there you go. You've got it.
Yeah, it already is. Yeah, it looks like water.
Yeah, be warned. It's so not water. Yeah. While we have Simon here, actually, from Ireland, let's just do a quick gallop through Brexit, shall we?
Oh, let me just down a drink.
So, Simon, you're not here in the guise of a political analyst, but tell us your Brexit view.
Oh, God. I think I'm still just hoping for a second referendum, and I'm still hoping it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And that's really it, you know? I don't think anyone really knows what's going to happen, so it's so hard to have an opinion on it. And I think that's kind of one of the big problems with the whole thing, is that, you know, kind of people kind of went into this and voted for something that they didn't actually know what they were voting for. So, I'm still just really kind of hoping for a second referendum.
What are the papers saying today? With the light touch, there's a few good cartoons.
Yes, well, good. I mean, funny, at least. So there's one in the Observer, I believe, it's funny. It's very easy to sum up. Basically, you see a few turkeys, and behind you can see Theresa May walking very quickly, and the geese are just commiserating on Theresa May, saying, "Oh, poor little thing." Of course, it's going to be the turkeys are going to be sacrificed for Christmas, but they are feeling for Theresa May. It means quite a lot. And the other very funny drawing is in the Sunday Times, and you can see basically the billboard of the of Jaws, the film, of course, the very famous film when a shark is doing a lot of damage, and you can see that. But in front of the very big shark, you can see Theresa May having a splash on how's it called? Skiing on the water, basically, with a bikini and the colour of the Union Jacks, with a big smile and being, I guess, quite sexy on this picture, which is quite scary, more scary perhaps than the shark itself. So, and of course, the title of the film is not Joe, is Project Fear 2, Project Fear, of course, Project Fear 2. So basically, it's like Theresa May is saying that everything is going to be all doom and gloom. And everyone's saying it's going to be all doom and gloom if Theresa May doesn't basically ride the waves with her deal. I guess that's the gist.
Yeah. I'd like to move on to the Sunday Telegraph now, because they're talking about the fact that one version of Hark the Herald Angels Sing has changed. They've replaced all mention of the virgin womb, which I think is kind of hilarious. I mean, for a long time, people have said this was the greatest excuse for a kind of slip up ever. Oh, well, I didn't really do it, Mum. So tell us more about this story.
So basically, yes, some bishops apparently are, some reverends are not really happy about the fact that indeed this carol has been changed, so that basically the words are not about the virginity of the of the Virgin Mary, but just that she so happened to be pregnant with a blessed child. And there's I can't find the right lyric, but basically just airbrushing the fact that she got pregnant without, well, having sex and being a virgin. And because many people don't really believe in the miracle of the virginity of the Virgin Mary, they decided that they would change this carol and just forget about the fact that it's mentioned in the carol. And some reverends are not really happy about that, because they're saying that it's kind of ruining the meaning of Christmas if we just airbrush and don't talk about this centerpiece of Christianity.
It's such a contentious issue. I think I'm just not even going to go there at this point. What I do want to talk about, though, as we bring this edition of Sunday Brunch to a close, is how to avoid Christmas burnout. Now, if you've been listening to the programme, you know there's been quite a lot of alcohol and food involved. How does one sustain this pace, really, until January? Simon, what would you advise?
Don't think about it, just
go with it. Yeah. What does the FT Weekend magazine say, Marie?
So it's a bit less festive in the FT, of course. Basically, they're saying that we want to have such a perfect Christmas so much that we just basically go burn out wanting to do everything in a perfect way. And that in Christmas time in particular, we should embrace the endlessness of doing nothing for no reason, just drawing or just, you know, singing with no reason, with no particular purpose. It's important not to have any purpose in Christmas, not even having fun, just nothing.
That's, well, do you know what? I think we could all drink to that. Yeah. Marie Bion and Simon Whiteside, who's the founder of Row at Pop Brixton, thank you so much for coming in to Sunday Brunch, and happy Christmas to all of
Christmas.
You.
Thank you for having
and
me.
To all of our listeners. And thanks to George McDonough, who produced the show, our studio manager, Sam Impey, and Mariana Lagrasta and Helena Jarit. You've been listening to Sunday Brunch. I'm Georgina Godwin. Happy Christmas and cheers. Bottoms up.
Cheers.
Happy Christmas.